So last week, we had a big sermon, we had a big topic, we had a big discussion. It was heavy. It was heavy. And when I went back to review it again, I realized that my sermon was 33 minutes long. So we're going to try and keep it a little shorter this week, but we're going to talk a little bit more because we had such a big conversation last week, and I know that after the worship service, a lot of people came up to me to talk about their concerns and concerns that they had about race relations in our country today and over many hundreds of years in the past. And so last week we talked about the progression from polarization between groups to dehumanization, when we start seeing people as a little less than, to demonization, where we start seeing people as wrong or evil or bad. And when that happens, and it can happen very quickly in societies sometimes, when that happens, it becomes very easy for violence to erupt, for killing to be justified, and we're seeing that play out today in our communities around this nation. It often happens, as we discussed, in societies like the society that Jesus was born into, where you have a dominant culture that has certain rights and privileges, and a minority culture that does not enjoy those same rights and privileges. And if they're ethnically different, if they look different, if the difference is discernible, then it's very easy for that polarization and that separation to occur. So last week, we ended with a prayer. Y'all remember the prayer? The prayer was, God, this is bigger than us. This is a certain level of societal sin that Christ talks about, and that we have great faith that God can heal. We may not be able to heal this on our own, because sometimes when societies become this polarized over this many hundreds of years, a small group of people can't fix all of that all by themselves, even if they're trying their best. And so we turned it over to God to help us to see what we needed to see and hear what we needed to hear. And if there's something that we really can do that can make a difference, we were open to that. And we wanted God to reveal that to us. How many people had a revelation this week? How many people saw something they hadn't seen before or felt like they got an answer? Really? Really? I did. As I was leaving the church and as I was thinking through the week, I realized that in my sermon, I left out a big piece, an important piece. We talked a lot about the social dynamics. We talked a lot about the stages of grief with anger and denial and depression and bargaining. We talked about looking towards acceptance where we can see the reality of society. And we opened it up to God. But what we didn't do is talk about our own part in it. And that's what's really hard for folk. Sometimes it's really hard for us to say we're nice people and we don't think that we are, you know, racist, we don't think that we're prejudiced, but then to go one step farther and say, but we still have a part in this problem. We still are participating in it. Even if we're good people, even if we didn't want to, we still have a part in it. And until we can see that, it's really hard to change the whole system as a whole. And what's interesting is then I got on Facebook a day or so later and saw that this is happening across the nation. The same thing that occurred to me for the first time is happening across the nation. There's a Twitter hashtag that's called Criming While White. Have you heard of this? Criming While White. I know. What it is people from the dominant culture in this nation are confessing, I have been in a situation where I enjoyed a privilege that other people did not enjoy. They're talking about being pulled over on the side of the highway and being given a ticket and not being assaulted by the officer. They're talking about being arrested for a petty theft and getting away with it with little or no penalty, while other friends that were there at the same time did not, because they were of color. it blew my mind. And it, to see this, it's happening. Hundreds and hundreds of people are posting these sorts of things. And they're talking about the privileges that they enjoy for the first time that they have been unwilling, that have been, they've been afraid to acknowledge or even see for most of their lives. And this is really interesting to me because as we're talking about the light of revelation, Simeon was a man who had somehow understood from God for most of his life that he would not die until he had seen the Messiah come. That was what he knew. That he, until he saw the Messiah come, he was going to stay alive. And then Jesus was born and he got to see him. And he says that God sent him to be a light for revelation. And what's interesting about revelation is that it's nothing new. It's simply opening our eyes to see what's been there the whole time. It's simply opening our eyes to see what has been there the whole time. Very much like pregnancy, where you know there's a baby there, all the signs are there. You may have morning sickness, you may feel kicking in your stomach, you may have a sonogram, you may crave certain foods, you may get a gigantic bulbous mass in front of you that bumps into things wherever you go and tips you over sometimes. But when you actually give birth, the baby is revealed for the first time. The baby was there the whole time, but you actually get to see it. You actually get to see that tiny bundle of joy. And so I want to tell you a little story about when I was in eighth grade. I met her in sixth grade. This happened in eighth grade science class. I was assigned a lab partner who was from another country. She did not speak English as a first language, and she had a thick accent. And we were working at a lab table that we shared with another lab set of lab partners. And at a certain point, while we were dissecting a frog, dead frog, it's really gross, she reached to pick up a pair of forceps off the table to do the next step with pulling this poor little frog's body apart. And a Caucasian boy on the other side of the table slapped her hand and grabbed the forceps and said, "Don't you touch my stuff." And she looked him square in the eye and she said, "Don't you talk to me that way." And it came out in a thick accent. And he started mocking her. He started pulling his eyes back into slits and putting his hands together and mimicking a very affected Chinese accent. And I was really angry to see this. So I said, "Don't you talk to her that way. You apologize right now." And he stopped and he looked a little frightened and he apologized. It never occurred to me that if someone behaved that way towards me and I told them to knock it off, that they would mock me for my accent or for my culture. It was a privilege that I enjoyed. I never had to worry about that. It was a privilege. We both said stop. She got a very different response than what I got. Do you see the difference? Very different privilege. So when we see Simeon talking about light for revelation, and last week we heard Zechariah talking about light in the darkness, a light that would end the hatred and the enemies that they were experiencing. When we talk about a light for revelation for the Gentiles, it says, it's very easy to think they're talking about metaphorical light, or metaphorical revelation. But I wonder if this wasn't very practical as well, that the discrimination and the mockery and the different set of privileges that the Israelites living in Jerusalem at that time were experiencing at the hands of the Romans, if they were not trying to reveal the love and the compassion to the Gentiles, to the Roman Empire, so that they would stop treating them that way. Lift up, open their eyes to see the privileges that they had that were better than the ethnic and religious minorities living within their borders, and helping to open their eyes to that so they could see the damage that it was doing. A light for revelation to the Gentiles. And when you see what Christ did, when he, throughout his life, as he was wandering around, meeting with different people again and again and again, he did these things to call this out. He expressed compassion to all people. He pointed out hypocrisy in the government and in the leadership of the temple whenever he saw it. And anytime someone came to him that others would consider less than, Christ embraced them. By example, he demonstrated by example. When little children came up and the apostles said, no, those are dirty little children, they're less than, Christ said, no, let them come to me. When the woman at the well said, well, I'm not of your same religion, and I'm divorced 5 times over, there's no way I could participate, he said, no, you come on in. You come on in. When people were affected by demons, the essence of demonization, Christ went and he healed them and he helped them and he embraced them. Lepers, any outcast that he found, anytime someone said, no, they should not be part of us, they should not be allowed near us, Christ did everything he could to bring them closer, to humanize them. And we see these efforts in modern day society. If you read news articles about Michael Brown, you'll see it's like they're just talking about two different people. On the one side, you see the polarization, dehumanization, and demonization, where they describe him as a criminal, as a thug. They'll mention the color of his skin. They'll talk about how the police officer described him as a demon. And right there, you see the polarization, dehumanization, and demonization in one, maybe two sentences. And then other news articles will describe him as a child, as a member of a family, as a student, and you see them trying to reinsert his humanity to lift that back up. One is deliberately trying to polarize and dehumanize and demonize. The other one is trying to rehumanize. And that's what we saw Christ do, was rehumanize people. And one of the main reasons that he did that was by actively embracing people and bringing them into the fold, and also through the practice of communion, by having people sit down together and eat with one another, because that's one of the most human things that we do. We all share that same need. So there was a time many years ago when my daughter Faye was 15 months old. This was before I had Rosemary, and I went to visit a friend who lived in Michigan. And this was one of the snowiest, blizzardiest, storminest winters on record. And I remember how bad it was because I was sitting in the San Francisco airport waiting to take off. And as I'd been waiting for the flight to board, you could see that they were delaying all the flights and then canceling all the flights. And it was only a matter of time before they got to us again and again and again. You'd see, you know, this flight's been delayed. Nope, now it's canceled. No, it's delayed. Now it's canceled. Every single other flight except for ours was canceled because they were talking about the blizzards and the snow and the weather conditions. And so my little 15-month-old baby and I get on this plane, and I'm just waiting for them to cancel it before we even start, you know, taxiing to take off. And I remember the captain got on the intercom, and he says, hello, this is your captain speaking. You all may have noticed that all of the other captains have canceled their flights due to weather conditions on the East Coast. Well, I want to assure you that I think the rest of those captains are a bunch of sissies, and we're going to do just fine. And then he gunned the engine. And the flight was delayed. We had to have several layovers to get there. And by the time we arrived, the flight was multiple hours late, and we got into Detroit, Michigan at 2 o'clock in the morning. And my friend had driven from Grand Rapids, which was a 2-hour drive away, to pick us up. Okay? And so we were driving and driving and driving at 30 miles an hour. We could not see in front of us. There were snowbanks at least 5-6 high on either 5-6 feet high on either side of the road. And by this point, because we'd been on an airplane for 9 hours, my daughter was done. Okay, she was done. There would be no more sitting in the car seat. There would be no more waiting. And so I was nursing her, and we had to keep pulling over to the side of the road. And I would nurse her and settle her down and put her in the car seat, and then she would go ballistic. And so, you know, we're in fits and starts, getting 2 miles at a time down the road, going about 20 miles an hour. And at a certain point, I didn't worry about crashing anymore, because all we would do is sort of slide into a really soft snowdrift and stop. So there was nothing hard to hit. And this went on for 2 hours. Now, keep in mind, we had been on the flight for 9. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. We were exhausted. And at a certain point, we pulled over into the parking lot of a motel to stop again because she was crying. And I was with my close friend, who is from another country, whose skin is many shades darker than mine. And I looked around this hotel parking lot, motel parking lot. At this point, we were about halfway between Detroit and Grand Rapids. It had taken us 2 hours to get that far. It was going to take at least 2 hours to get home. And I said, you know what? Why don't I just pay for a motel room for tonight? Let's just stop. Let's go inside. They got to have a room. We can get a good night's sleep. Maybe the weather will clear by tomorrow morning, because Faye's done, and I'm done, and you're done, and this isn't safe anymore. I thought that was a pretty good solution, don't you think? I mean, it's what, $50 for a good night's sleep? This seemed like a great solution. And she said, why don't you just try nursing her one more time, and then maybe we can keep going. I said, no, let's stop. This is perfectly fine. We'll stop. Why don't you try nursing her one more time? Maybe you could even hold her and we can drive. I said, no, really, it's not a problem. I'll pay for the motel room. Let's just stop. And she said, Tracy, auntie, that's what her children call me. Tracy, auntie, take a look around the parking lot. I want you to notice that every single vehicle parked in the parking lot is a pickup truck. And every single truck has a gun rack in the back. She said, when my husband and I drive past this area, even if we're having car trouble, we don't stop. Her husband is a person of color as well. We don't stop. It wouldn't be safe for us to get out of the car here. And so I said, okay, I looked around the parking lot. I saw the gun racks. Didn't really worry me, but for her benefit, because I cared about her and I respected her decision and her opinion, we kept on going. And what we did was we just drove 20 miles an hour, and I just held Faye in my arms, and it took us 2 hours to get home. We got home at 6 o'clock in the morning. I didn't have to worry about things like that. I didn't have to worry about my physical safety. I could go into any motel I wanted to and trust that they would treat me well, that I would find safety and shelter. She did not have that same privilege. She and her husband did not have that same privilege. And it had always been like that. It had always been there. But at that moment, it was revealed to me. My eyes were opened. So, a couple of weeks later, there was a national news story that hit that talked about how the Ku Klux Klan was going to be holding an auction of all of their stuff. Many, many families that had been members of the Ku Klux Klan were going to be auctioning off their stuff at this big auction. And I remember them interviewing the auctioneer. The families remained anonymous, but there was this, what would you call him, a good old boy. Cowboy hat, button-down shirt with a couple of buttons open, sitting in his chair, and surrounded by all of this stuff that would give us the willies, right? The white robes, the swastikas, the scepters, all this stuff that was going to be in the auction. And they were interviewing him, asking him if this was going to be charity, donated to charity, like if all the proceeds would then be donated to the NAACP or something. You could tell the reporter was trying to find something redeeming about this whole auction. And the auctioneer said, well, no, of course not. All the money is just going to go to the families. They were just selling all this stuff to make a few bucks. And they said the name of the town. I don't remember the name of the town, but they qualified it by saying, this is a town that's about an hour west of Detroit. That was exactly the area that we were when we stopped that night. Never even occurred to me to be aware of that. And I called my friend. I said, did you know that's that place? Did you hear about this story? And she says, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, we're very aware of all the activity the KKK has along this corridor and in this area. I did not have to be aware of that. I didn't have to worry about it. It had never even been on my radar. But she had to be aware of it. And her husband had to be aware of it, and their sons had to be aware of it. That's a privilege that I enjoyed. The feeling of safety, the feeling of security, the feeling of not having to worry about things like that, because it did not affect me the same way it would affect them. Does it all make sense to you? Yeah. It was revealed to me, a light of revelation. So we're seeing this on a national level now. It's coming more and more frequently. People are opening their eyes and opening their mouths to speak to this problem and their participation in it and how they benefit from it and how they see it. And it's not okay with them. And so we see hearts and minds being changed across the nation. And I really think that this has been a long time coming. And this is very much what was happening at the time when Christ was born. Because shortly after his death, within 30 years of his death, the people of Jerusalem rallied and they staged a rebellion and they threw the Roman government out of Jerusalem. Now, they ended up losing that battle. It took them 2 years, and they did lose. But it started a momentum that carried and carried and carried. And you could see the momentum gathering and the eyes being open. And you see it throughout the books of Acts with things like Paul, who was a corrupt leader. But his eyes were opened, and he was able to then turn around and start helping people instead of persecuting people. You see it again and again and again. You see it with Nicodemus coming to Christ in the middle of the night, a corrupt leader who had immense power coming to him to talk to him one-on-one as a person. And when we see it in the book of Matthew, when we talk about when we've gone from polarization to dehumanization to demonization, and we talk about stopping calling people evil, stop making those associations, and we rehumanize them so we don't see them as less than human anymore. And when we talk about ending that polarization so we can see them eye to eye, face to face, see their humanity, that's exactly what Christ talks to us about in the book of Matthew, where he says, whenever you saw someone who was hungry and you gave them something to eat, you were doing that for me. That was me. Whenever you saw someone who was thirsty and you gave them something to drink, that was me. Whenever you saw someone who was a prisoner and you visited them, that was me. And whenever you saw someone who was an alien or a sojourner or a refugee or an immigrant, and you welcomed them and gave them sanctuary, that was me. He ended the demonization. Criminals, prisoners, illegal aliens. Whew. They're people, just like me. The dehumanization, well, they're just poor. They can't feed themselves. You know, those people, phew, they're just like me. He ended the polarization. They aren't us and them anymore. It's not me and you anymore. They're all me. I am the people. The people are me. No more polarization. And he took it one step further. He didn't just rehumanize people. Because Christ said, when you were doing this for me, for them, you were doing it for me. He was seeing in people, he was lifting up not only their humanity, but also their godliness. Because if Christ was in all of them, then they were not only human, they were godly. And whenever you look at the people, whenever you are eating and breaking bread with the people that are hungry or poor or prisoners or immigrants, Christ tells us that when you look at them, you must see their inherent humanity and also their inherent godliness. That is the model. That is the promise. That is the hope that we have during Advent, that is the anticipation of a world where we can see each other in this way. But it doesn't just happen magically. You have to work for it. You have to fight for it. You have to open your eyes and be willing to see what is right in front of you. All of the privileges that we enjoy, all of the way that we participate in the system, even if it's through our own ignorance, even if it's through our own sense of entitlement that we don't even have to see, because it doesn't affect us if we don't. That is the hope of Advent. And so I encourage you to keep praying, to keep listening, to keep waiting, and to keep opening your eyes to new possibilities, to be able to see what is right in front of our noses. We just haven't seen it yet. Can I get an amen to that?